Weather Brains episode number 381 for the 13th of May, a lovely May day for much of the Fruited Plain. I'm James Spann. Thanks for taking the time to join us. We gather around the digital mahogany table every week and we talk about our favorite subject, the science of meteorology and the topic of weather. And let's go around the table quickly and do some introductions. We have a great guest on the show this week, but let's begin with the internationally beloved meteorologist, Brian Peters, who has been hanging out with babes. Brian, you want to explain yourself?
I have. It was a great weekend.
Title.
We have this little festival we do on Mother's Day weekend. It's a Friday night and Saturday. And I actually had a co-host for much of the weekend. I do the emceeing for the event, and it's a music festival. I had a co-host this weekend, or co-hostess, I should say. It's Miss Cahaba Valley, Amanda Ford. She'll be in the Miss Alabama competition in June. So, and she's from my little town here of Helena, Alabama. So have somebody to pull for. I may actually be watching a beauty contest.
How old is this girl, Brian?
Oh, I didn't ask a question like that.
So you got this dirty old man hanging out with these 20, you know, 1-year-old girls.
She hasn't graduated from Troy State yet, so she's probably like 20.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, so, Brian, how's your life other than hanging out with babes? And by the way, we got to do some live television together. I thought that was magical. But how are you, other than the babe magnet thing, how are you?
I'm doing great. And boy, hasn't this weather been wonderful? I was looking at the highs in central Alabama, which I think represents the southeastern U.S. Our average high for the first 12 days of the month is 10 degrees below the 30-year average. Isn't that wonderful?
It is. But, you know, I get occasional hate mail, Brian, from your comments. Because you forget that
it's all because of global warming.
Wait a minute. Hang on.
I'm doing everything I can to
flush down the tubes already. people are angry because you don't consider that most of our guests and listeners don't live where you live. And they say when you come in there and talk about nice weather, it's bad weather where they live.
Well.
So.
Come move to Alabama then.
There you go. Well, all right. No, it was nice where we happened to be. But for some people, it was, you know, temperatures were up in the 90s today. The heat, bad.
I know. Wasn't that terrible?
We had, you know, Billings, Montana hit 92. Bismarck 91. So see, our friends in Montana and North Dakota have been offended by your saying what beautiful weather we're having while they're like a raisin drying up in the heat. So. But move to Brian's neighborhood. That's the message.
Kevin, that's what they get for living in Montana.
So, Kevin, are you burning up? I love Montana. Boy.
I do, too.
So, Kevin, do you love Montana?
I love Montana. I would like to go there sometime.
Kevin Selly is our intellectual meteorologist here. We call you the intellectual meteorologist.
Since when?
Well, it's a new title that I just gave you because you are an intellectual man that writes great posts on the digital
titles all over the
digital
place.
Meteorologist blog, and you're in Dallas-Fort Worth, and a man of high. You look like the thinker. You kind of got that side look, you know, that angle you've got. It just makes you look smart. You know, for those of us with these head-on shots, we look like, you know, buffoons, but you look smart. So tell us something intellectual.
Well, speaking of the digital meteorologist blog, I came up with a great idea based on a post I did. In fact, you can do the breaking news thing. You got the breaking news thing?
We're going to do something.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
Fred Wilson is a venture capitalist in New York. He writes the AVC blog, and very well-known guy, a very smart guy. And the other day, he posted a picture of his home screen from his Android phone, and it had all of his apps on there. And right smack dab in the middle was the Weather Channel app. I didn't see any evidence of any other weather app, and I thought this would be a great opportunity for us to gather some information from the great Weather Brains army. And I thought maybe we should do a little contest and have everybody send a screenshot of your home screen or your weather folder, because we want to see what apps you're using, which ones you have right up front on the home screen, which ones you have in a folder, because I'm sure we all have multiple apps, and I know I have a bunch in my folder. But I thought we could do a little contest. So if you send us, and I'm going to give you the address, not the regular email address, but if you send us screenshots of your smartphone and which weather apps you have. We're going to do a little contest. We'll pick at random from all of the entries. And James, you have a special prize for the one winner.
It is a James Spann bobblehead doll.
This is exciting.
I mean, we've spared no expense. Let me be sure I got the idea right. All right, so you're saying that this is like...
Oh, you have all folders on yours.
Yes, but so you just want the like, there's multiple pages of these things. I mean, so you want the front page.
The one with the most folders should win.
Well, you can... Yeah, no kidding. You can send this... Let me put it this way. You can attach as many as you want. Just send one email, but you can attach as many as you want. But the point of the exercise is for us to see which apps you are using, which ones, and maybe which ones are your favorites. That's kind of the goal of the whole thing. But I think that would be really fun, really interesting. I know that, and I wrote a short post about this on the Digital Meteorologist blog. I know that the Weather Brains audience is not, you know, considered normal. We're all better and smarter than normal. But I think that it would
and
be.
And I've been insulting the audience.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
No, I said we're all better than normal. So I think it would be an interesting thing. So here's the address. Now, and you won't be included. If you send it to email@weatherbrains.com, you're not going to be in for the bobblehead. Is this, by the way, is this a new, I mean, I know is it look different than the original bobblehead?
Oh, yeah. This thing looks like I'm on the sixth day of a 5-day drunk. I mean, it looks like I've been punched in the eyeball. And the only thing they did for me is they made me thinner on this one. I was not as pudgy as the first one. And it talks.
That's but he fun. Talks.
It talks.
Oh, really?
So it's the James Spann 2.0 that talks. And what you need to do, trust me, these things have zero value. But what you need put it on eBay. And some of these people might give you, you know, $50. I've had offers in the last week. No,
$50 is value.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
You buy dinner with that.
That is your value. That is your value, is to take that thing and put it up on eBay and flush it right now, because for whatever reason, there's some people that are willing to pay as much as like $100 for this thing. So
was there one really $100?
I've had an offer. For $100, and but due to the, you know, they got these FCC contest rules and the lawyers. I don't even have one. So
I've got one. Let's do this. And so let's do this. The winner gets a James Spann bobblehead. But if you will, how about you sign it, and then it'll be worth only $1.50.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. That's it.
Will you sign it, though?
Yes. So, again, so you really want the home screen and the weather folder.
Yes.
Our guest will be glad to know that MPing is in my weather folder.
Oh, nice.
But right. Maybe we should post our own too. So do you want to do the contest
rules?
Here's
the address.
Oh, yeah, address
here's
first.
Here's the address. Yeah, here's the address. It's myapps, MyApps, at weatherbrains.com. We'll mention that periodically through the show, and perhaps Brian can put it up on the website for us. But it's myapps at weatherbrains.com. You'll be entered, and just send one. It's not going to help you to send, you know, 1,000 times. So myapps at weatherbrains.com. Now, since this is a contest, we had to be careful, and so we called in the lawyers, and Matthew's going to explain what we got from the lawyers.
Weatherbrains International uses the law firm of Dewey, Cheatham and Howe. All contest entries are subject to the following. Objects in mirror are closer than they appear. Any resemblance to real persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental. Sell before date on carton. Contents under pressure. Under 17, not admitted without parent. Void where prohibited. Some assembly required. Batteries not included. Some settling of contents may occur during shipping. Use only as directed. Do not use while operating a motor vehicle or heavy equipment. May be too intense for some viewers. Do not disturb. If condition persists, consult your physician. No user serviceable parts inside. Freshest if eaten before date on carton. No postage necessary if mailed in the United States. Breaking seal constitutes acceptance of agreement. As seen on TV, one size fits all. Past performance does not guarantee future results. Colors may fade. Slippery when wet. Parental guidance suggested. Do not bend, fold, spindle, or mutilate. Use unleaded fuel only. Not affiliated with the American Red Cross. Drop in any mailbox. Edited to fit your screen. For sale by prescription only. Return to sender. Participating locations only. Your mileage may vary. Substantial penalty for early withdrawal. Avoid contact with state. Sanitized for your protection. Sign here. Items sold separately. Slightly higher in California. Employees and their families are not eligible. Limited time offer. Must be present to win. No purchase necessary. Use only in well-ventilated area. Keep away from fire or flame. Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or other use of the pictures and accounts of this game without the express written consent of Major League Baseball is prohibited. Some equipment shown is optional. Don't try this at home. Dispose of properly. No Canadian coins. Not recommended for children. Do not immerse in water. No solicitors. No alcohol, dogs, or horses. Driver does not carry cash. No bills over $20 accepted. Price does not include taxes, titles, destination charges, or dealer prep. No wagering. Equal opportunity employer. This supersedes all previous notices. This information is subject to change without notice. All rights reserved. Contest ends 11:59 p.m. Sunday, January 19th, 2013.
Okay, so there you go.
Do not taunt Happy Fun Ball. Yeah. Happy Fun Ball is not a toy.
There you go.
That is an all-time classic.
All right, so those are the rules, and send it to myapps, M-Y-A-P-P-S, at weatherbrains.com.
All right, there you go. So that's the situation. Excellent.
There you go.
All right.
Do we need the rules again, or did you get them?
We might play those at the end of the show in case somebody missed one of them. There were some classics in there.
Just want to be safe.
Let's quickly bring in the other panelists, and Bill's going to introduce our special guest because we have kept him up way late here. J.B. Elliott is the world's greatest weatherman who's been absent for the last couple of weeks. Bill Murray and J.B. have both been AWOL, but they're both back. So, JB, any profound words of wisdom that you'd like to share with our international audience?
I don't have any apps.
All right.
There you go. Just, JB, send us a picture of your lunch, and we'll throw you in the contest. How about that?
Okay. It was a turkey pot pie and a glass of water.
And that's it? No bananas or Vienna sausages?
Ice water came from the Fort Payne Aquifer. Real good water.
You don't do bottled water, do you, JB?
No.
You don't do Starbucks, do you?
No.
What do you think Starbucks coffee tastes like, JB?
Slop.
That ended any that chance of Starbucks ever advertising on this show, as Kevin just noted there. Yeah. All right, Nate Johnson, who loves Starbucks. Nate, you want to do a rebuttal to JB's comments there?
I'm actually not a big Starbucks guy. I don't do coffee.
You look like a Starbucks guy. You look like one of these coffee snobs.
No.
No?
I'm a Cheerwine snob. There you go. That's the stuff right there, kids.
I don't do coffee either, Nate, but I do Frappuccinos.
Whatever. It's a coffee-like beverage. They're going to charge you $8 for it at Starbucks. It's not worth it.
They just had a half-price sale.
I can get two 12-packs of this for what it costs for one Frappuccino, and I'd much rather have this.
What is that, beer? What is that stuff, Nate?
No, it's called Cheerwine. It's a drink that it's been around about 100 years, 1917, and... It's based in Salisbury, North Carolina, and it's a cherry-flavored soft drink, but it's not Cherry Coke. It's not anything like that. It's its own thing, and it's people who listen to the show who live in the Southeast know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Send me an email. You know what I'm talking about. This is good stuff. Anyway.
All right. So I did discover those orange cream sodas by Stewart's. You can buy those at the Cracker Barrel just down the road. The next exit down, they've got them down there. So maybe they've got some of that red wine or whatever it is you're drinking there. And it is not working for me walking down there in my TV clothes. Hey, have you got any red wine in a can?
In a brown paper bag.
Cheer wine. Yeah, cheer wine.
And it is non-alcoholic. There's not a drop of alcohol in this, so it's all good.
All right.
That's what JB says about the Buffalo Rock, too.
Yeah. All right. Well, Bill Murray, the floor is yours. Bring in our special guest because everybody's been dying to hear.
I'm going to pass back to Nate to introduce the guest, but James, I have to share something on my screen. You know, you say those James Spann bobbleheads are going for $100 a piece. Well, there's a plethora of Brian Peters right now.
Brian Peters, you can get your Brian Peters bobblehead for 20. What was the bid on that thing? $20?
$20. You can buy it now.
Wow!
So, wow!
Anyway, I'm waiting for one of Dave Beard.
Dave's our local news anchor here.
Dave, I'll pass it back to you so you can introduce the guest.
All right. Well, through much trial and travail, he has stuck with us, and we appreciate it. He'd normally be done by now. We're just now getting started. But we appreciate Dr. Kim Elmore hanging out with us. He is a research scientist with the Cooperative Institute for Mesoscale Meteorological Studies. I took me a second. I'll get there. He's also an adjunct professor of meteorology at the University of Oklahoma. He was a part of the Vortex 2 project on the SR2 mobile radar team. Before that, he was an associate scientist with the Research Applications Program at NCAR. His current project is known by its very onomatopoeic name, Impeach. The Mobile Precipitation Identification Near the Ground Project. They just released a new mobile app that I'm sure we'll talk about here in the next little bit. When he's not at work, he's a husband, a father, a runner, a single and multiple engine and glider rated pilot. Beat that, James Spann. Oh, yeah, he's an extra class amateur radio operator. And as if that wasn't enough, by the way, I think we found somebody who does more with his time than James Spann does, and that's saying something. He is a violinist with the Civic Orchestra in Norman, and a violinist first chair with the National Weather Center's new performing ensemble, Helical Flow. I love that. Wow. That's awesome. Dr. Kim Elmore, welcome.
Sounds like he's Batman.
So tell us a little bit about MPing and where this came from, where this idea came from, and what you hope to do with all this data you're collecting.
That's a lot of questions all at once.
I got to get them in while the technology works.
Yeah. Or before he hangs up on us.
That's right. Computers here to make our lives easier, less stressful, and more productive. Choose any two. well, actually, MPing got its start in 2006. I got curious about how well the current hydrometeor classification algorithm works if we try to use it to identify precipitation type at the surface. And so what we did was we built this kludgy web page that people would enter observations on. And the easiest thing was to enter the observation, but you had to know your latitude and your longitude and the time and all that other stuff. And once you entered that, then that fell into a database. And we did that for... We got lucky in the winter of 2006-2007, and we had a pretty healthy set of winter storms that came through. And out of all of that, we gathered up about 2,500, roughly, observations from people that were just around here. We were running the algorithm on the WSR-88D prototype radar, which here is called KOUN. And so then we took that data and we matched it up with the locations of all the observers, according to what they told us. And we compared what they said they saw with what the radar thought it saw to figure out just how well it does if we misapply the HCA this way. And I say that pretty carefully because the HCA was never meant to be used that way. The HCA was intended for warm weather. It was intended for use out in the radar volume. So that's up in the air, not at the surface. And it's one of its main duties was to actually help us figure out how to more accurately estimate the amount of rainfall that comes down. Not so much the nature of the hydrometeor that actually makes it to the ground. Its other big duty was to tell us whether or not there was hail. Does a good job of that. It does a good job of helping us make the rainfall estimates more accurate, but we learned that it didn't do particularly well telling us about the nature of the precipitation that would fall to the ground. So that got some attention, and the director of the lab, Dr. Steve Koch, decided that we really need to do something about this and develop a hydrometeor classification algorithm that works at the surface instead of up in the radar volume where nobody is. And so in order to do that, we had to expand the observations that we got. We originally started by actually making active calls, telephone calls. We hired undergraduates and gave them a database and some radar information and somebody else in there to help guide them. And told them, okay, call into these particular areas because we think it's interesting there. And that netted us in the 2011-2012 winter, it netted us about 1,200 observations. What we learned was this is a lot harder than it seemed to find interesting areas of precipitation. And for us, interesting isn't just snow or just rain. It's like stuff with ice pellets and stuff with freezing precipitation and mixtures of rain and snow and snow and sleet and rain and sleet and all these other things. It's hard to find them. And then as we were talking about this to other National Weather Service people, somebody, I don't want to take credit for this where it's not due, somebody I think in the Western region just happened to quip, you know, there ought to be an app for that. And we said, well, yeah, there ought to be, but nobody here develops apps. We're the National Severe Storms Laboratory. We develop huge code for fluid dynamics and mesoscale storms and cloud model simulations for thunderstorms, and nobody here does apps. So we were thinking about this because it would really be a great idea, but nobody does apps. And I happened to run into one of the PhD candidates who was the outgoing president of the OU Amateur Radio Club. And I'm the faculty advisor. And he showed me his iPhone and he said, hey, look at this. It's a new app. I said, oh, that's pretty cool. Where did you get it? And he said, I wrote it. And I said, you write apps? He said, oh, yeah, I write apps. I sell them. I make a little money on the side with it. And I said, sit down here for a minute. And I said, gave him the idea of what we want to do. And he says, oh, yeah, it shouldn't be too hard. And I said, well, there's a catch. There isn't any money for this. We don't have support for you. And he said, that's okay. I can do it in my spare time. And sure enough, he did. And so that was the very first app that we saw that did anything like what we wanted to do. And we did a little bit of research and decided that, you know, iPhones are not the only thing that's out there. The most common thing that's out there is the Android platform. I wonder if anybody here would be willing to take that on. And so we found another guy here at the lab. His name is Lakshmanan. And or he goes by Locke for obvious reasons. And he said, sure, I'll take it on. I've done a little bit of stuff like this just for fun. And so that was the first release of what we called MPing, for Mobile Precipitation Identification Near the Ground. That happened December 19th of 2012. And since then, we've collected on the order, I didn't look before we got started, but on the order of about 250,000 submissions from about 35,000 downloads. And of that number, about 220,000 or so, 230,000, are observations of precipitation of some type or another. And that includes, by the way, legitimate observations of none. When you get into the to the app, you'll see that you can also submit observations of test just to make sure the thing works. And so that doesn't tell us anything. That's just used mainly so the user can check out the how well it works. But then we have observations of all of the different kinds of things. And we've collected, since December 19th, 2012, about 250,000 observations.
Wow.
Very cool. And so the long-term goal of this is to take all those observations, compare them to, are you just going to look at radar data, or are you going to look at model data plus radar data to try and create that new, this is what's happening at the ground product?
The answer to that would be yes. It's both. Right now we're working on using what we call just a background classifier. And that's a classifier that just works on the model analysis data. And so each model starts with an initial analysis, and we happen to be using the initial analysis from the high-resolution rapid refresh model, which is it's actually used for the analysis of the rapid update the RAP, the rapid refresh model, but at a lower resolution. So the HER, the high resolution rapid refresh model, runs at a 3 kilometer resolution, and the current RAP runs at 13 kilometer resolution. It's both the same initial analysis, but different dynamic cores in both models. In any event, that's the analysis we use, the idea being that's the best guess of the state of the atmosphere. And once we get a background classifier that has been shown to work well with that, then we're going to add radar data to it when we're within a particular range of the radar. Once you get far away from the radar, especially in winter weather, it's above all the weather and doesn't see anything. So it's not very useful. And as you get further away from the radar, obviously you get further above the ground. And so how useful the radar data is sort of varies with range. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have to figure out how that works.
So I guess one of the interesting things, and I know that a couple of grad students there have taken the data and made them available. You can get them on the website, which is really cool to watch in real time if something is developing, but also has made a couple of place files that folks can load into the Gibson Ridge software and others to be able to display that in real time. Do you anticipate that becoming, is this potentially an operational product? I mean, is this something that the local offices, Weather Service offices can tap into and look at? And have you heard of anybody doing that for sort of real-time reports of what's going on?
Well, let's see. The answer to all of that is yes, but I'll elaborate. What have we got? Nothing but time, right? The grad student who developed the original app is named Zach Flamig, and he has developed XML files of the database. The guy who developed the place file is actually another National Weather Service employee, and he develops a place file based on the web display that we have. That wasn't developed by a grad student. That was developed by another regular employee at the lab, another employee of the Cooperative Institute. And he, because, again, this was done off director's funds, and so there's not a lot of money for it right now. And so he reused some stuff that comes off of a different website that's more research-oriented than operationally oriented. Part of the reason we did that was because people get pretty frustrated when they just submit data and it disappears into a black hole. Mm-hmm. They don't get to see what it looks like. They don't get to see. It stops being very interesting. I mean, you tap a button on your iPhone and, well, where's the fun in that?
Yeah.
So we wanted to make sure people could see the observations that were being submitted. And we then decided to make the observations public. This isn't a closed data set. We degrade the location information a little bit for purposes of privacy. Mm-hmm. Also for purposes of privacy, all of the observations, all of the people that submit observations are anonymous. Mm-hmm. We don't collect any information about who they are. That's actually for a couple of reasons. One, the main reason is privacy. People are sensitive to privacy, and we don't want to violate that, and we don't need to know who they are in order to use their data. The other reason is we wanted to avoid any kind of entanglements with an internal review board here at the university.
Yeah.
And so we decided we don't collect any information about who downloads it. We don't collect any information about who they are. All we know is where they were when they submitted the report. And so we keep it anonymous. And what was the rest of the question?
The question was, are any Weather Service offices using this in real time?
Yes. We're aware of some that are, and of more that have become very interested in it, especially now that we've had come out with the new release. And there's actually work being done right now to include these observations in the AWIPS data stream, both AWIPS 1 and AWIPS 2.
Sweet. James, I want you to roll the breaking news alert for just a moment, please.
Oh, all right. Stand by.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
Can tell you from the this bulletin in from the Canadian Space Agency, and a lot of folks in this program have been following Commander Chris Hadfield from the International Space Station. Their Soyuz capsule has now landed in Kazakhstan.
Yay.
Reported that is a safe landing. I'm not getting that from an official source. I know they've touched down. And so we'll hope to hear from them very soon. But very exciting stuff. Cheering at the Canadian Space Agency headquarters there. A lot of folks. So you want to talk about a national hero. This is as close as you get anymore is Hadfield up in Canada. This has been really cool to watch. So anyway, I had that up on a second window over here.
And if you haven't seen it, you got to watch the ground control to Major Tung video that he did.
Space Oddity.
It was too good.
It's good stuff. All right. Well, I will go back to the interview. Just wanted to mention that if anybody was watching live and had to choose between watching this and something else, we're glad you stuck with us. But anyway, so the Imping, it's now a mobile app. It's on iPhone, Android. The data are available, and this is turning into something cool. And you said you're up to something, 250,000 observations so far?
Yeah, on the order of 250,000. I'd have to look to know what they are right now, but yeah, on the order of 250,000.
And how do folks, is this going to be an ongoing thing? I mean, you mentioned that there wasn't officially support for it. Is this the kind of thing that they're going to, that could die as a result of sequester, or is it just sort of running on its own now and likely to continue into the near and long-term future?
I think it's going to keep going into the near and long-term future. It's the only thing like it out there. It seems a little bit nutty to say, but observations of this kind of spatial and temporal resolution just haven't been gathered in the past. And we're asking people to send us observations of stuff that's really easy to observe. Everybody pretty much knows what this stuff is. And so it's probably going to continue on. It's gathering momentum, I guess. It's been remarkably successful. And so it's very unlikely to go away. It's unlikely to go away for a lot of reasons. The National Weather Service likes it a lot. Mm-hmm. And if it were really threatened, somebody somehow would figure out how to make sure that it survives. It's not terribly threatened right now. Mm-hmm. Once we've got it going, now the big expense is really paying people to continue to work on it, mm-hmm. to do research with it. People like me and some of the other people here that do research. We did get a little bit of money, and I'm not exactly sure where it came from. And that's going to be used to enhance the web interface. So the display of the data that people submit is a little bit nicer, and easier to manipulate.
Kim, you said something interesting about threatened. It made me think, is there some level of concern for quality control about people sending in false results and things like that, especially as time goes on, as people creep in and learn about it?
That's a fantastic question. And that's the beauty of crowdsourcing, which is what this is. We didn't think of it. It's been around for a long time. The beauty of crowdsourcing is that a broad conspiracy to pollute the database is pretty unlikely. And so most people, the vast majority of people that submit observations, do so in good faith. They do the very best they can do. There's a few that we get that are obviously wrong, but they really stand out from the rest. And so the quality control from that standpoint is almost trivial. It's very difficult to pollute a database like this. Now, we've done a few other things to prevent problems. One of the things we do is we throttle the rate at which any individual device can generate reports. Initially, we throttled it at 5 minutes because that's sufficient for winter weather. Stuff just doesn't change terribly fast in winter weather. But we've loosened that up to 30 seconds with the current app, because in convective weather, things can change pretty quickly. And one of the things that we're very interested in is the occurrence of hail and the size of the hail that occurs. It's pretty important to know that it's still useful to us if people report rain. And it's useful to us if people report nothing prior to the onset of precipitation, and then after it ends to report none. None doesn't help us on severe clear days, but it does help us in cases like that. Because rain is a not hail report, if that makes any sense. So just knowing where there's hail doesn't tell us where there isn't hail. And so this is useful information. It is a null hail report. And so that's it's useful for to us to get reports of rain, even though that's the only thing that's going to fall in the summertime. It's still useful. And so, yeah, this is all going to be distributed via AWIPS to the National Weather Service nationally, and they're going to use it in whatever way they see fit.
Now, you guys have just recently added some new report types, including one that starts with a letter T. Can you tell us a little bit about the new ads and why you added them?
Okay. Yeah. We've added the ability for users to report tornadoes and waterspouts. We've also added the ability of users to report flooding, along with damage from storms. We have 4 levels of flooding, 5 levels of damage. Users can also report landslides, mudslides. And finally, and they can report, that sounds odd, but I'll get to that in a minute. And they can also report restrictions to visibility, dust storms or dense fog. And these aren't we're not looking for minor restrictions. We're looking for stuff that you wouldn't want to drive into if you had your choice. So we've added those categories. Now we added the tornado category and the waterspout category, mainly because it would be useful to the National Weather Service. But it's important to understand that those are not displayed publicly. Those aren't displayed publicly for a number of reasons, one of which we want the responsibility for issuing warnings and to interpret the data with which to issue warnings to rest solely with the National Weather Service. If somebody someplace were to report a tornado spuriously, they could do it because they made a mistake, they could do it because they didn't know what they were looking at, they could do it to be nefarious. That could cause problems. And so we choose to let the National Weather Service filter all of that. And so the reports are used, and the reports go to the National Weather Service, but they're not displayed publicly.
Interesting. So I want to, unless anybody's got another question about NPing, I want to talk a little bit about Vortex and your experience there. You were on one of the mobile radar teams. What was your role on that team?
Well, I was primarily the driver, although I understand radar and I understand electronics. Occasionally, I actually fixed stuff, minor stuff. I would help out with getting the radar leveled, getting the radar positioned, looking for places to put it. You can't just stop anywhere. And making sure that we weren't in any kind of hazard at any point. So the actual operator was a grad student. His name is Dan Betton. He would be inside, and it was my job to be outside and keep my head on a swivel and make sure that we're not about to get run over by something that we'd rather not be run over by. And so it was a team effort. We would coordinate navigation together. We would coordinate nowcasts to figure out where we should go right now, whether we should decide to move, not because we were necessarily in jeopardy, but because we didn't have a good viewing angle or we didn't have a good sight or the weather has moved to where we're blocked. And so it was all of stuff like that. The basic decision about where the general area of where we should go was made by the command and control center. We would occasionally stop and take a look to get information back to them. But for the most part, they knew what they needed to know, and they would disperse the resources as they saw fit to meet whatever the research goals were for the day.
Sweet. Did you guys see anything interesting? I know the Vortex, at least that first year, tornadoes were hard to come by. Did y'all see anything exciting from your vantage point?
Not a lot. It was a tough year. It seems easy. It seems like a trivial task. Go out, chase tornadoes, look at it with the radar, come back with data. The hard part is to move that much stuff, mobile radars and mobile mesonets and balloon crews and everything else to the area where you're close enough to actually see a tornado. There were tornadoes the first year of Vortex 2, but they tended to be where we weren't. Mm-hmm. The second year we did a lot better. Let's see, what year did we see the tornado in Wyoming? I think that was the first year. That was the one that we saw, and we actually scanned it from an abandoned missile silo. Nobody came to run us off, so we knew it was okay. And so we saw all kinds of stuff. Actually, the second year was one of the more surprising ones. We wound up misunderstanding an instruction, and we continued on when we had been requested to turn around and go someplace else. It turns out it was fortuitous because we wound up in the right place. But we topped a hill, and we saw two gustnadoes, beautiful gustnadoes with really tall dust columns in the vortex, and it was pretty impressive. So we knew conditions weren't too bad. That was the only time when we got stuck between a mesocyclone and a hail shaft, and so we couldn't go anywhere. Unfortunately, we stayed in between the two, so nobody got scared. No antennas got damaged. So it all turned out.
Some expensive hail damage if one of those radars gets taken out.
Oh, especially the dual pole radar. Yeah, yeah. That would be $100,000 just for the antenna.
Oh. So what's next? We go back to Imping and your work. What other projects are you working on, and what's right around the corner that we should start getting excited about?
Well, Imping is certainly taking a lot of my time right now. Imping is the visible part, and supplying the observations is the visible part, and looking at them on the map is the visible part. But that's not really the research that has to be done. The research that has to be done is to parse all the observations, do the quality check. A lot of what I do here, I'm a PhD meteorologist, but in the process of getting my PhD, I learned a whole lot about statistics. And so I'm kind of the statistics guy working on this project. And there's a couple of us here at the lab that are really good at statistics and that are well-versed, although we're not formally trained statisticians. We're PhDs, so we should be able to learn whatever we need to learn about it. So I'm involved in doing the actual generating the actual classification model and doing the validation work for anything that's developed. We use these data for both validation. So here's something that generates precipitation classes. How well does it work? And then we use the data to generate a classification model. So here's what the data said. Here's what the radar saw. Here's what the analysis says, the analyzed sounding looks like. Given all these things, what are people going to tell us that they see at the ground? In a lot of the QC stuff, we're also just learning what this data actually looks like. One of the interesting aspects of it is how variable is it? When you look at all the categories we have a bunch of categories. But then we have to look at it and say, okay, how well can people really discriminate between all these different categories? Mm-hmm. And what do we think we can actually do with it? We still want all the categories. We won't know unless we see them all. But we don't necessarily use the categories as people submit them to us. We may collapse them down to fewer categories. Mm-hmm. And then we validate how well we do. It's important to understand that when you start doing problems, attacking problems like this, classification problems, the more categories you have, the more classes you have of things that you try to classify, the more ways you can be wrong about it. Mm-hmm. The easiest, the simplest, it's not always easy, but the simplest breakdown is two classes, like a yes-no. Mm-hmm. After that, it gets more complicated, and there's more ways to be wrong. And so we have to balance the number of categories we have to, first of all, what's important to find, and what do we think we can really discriminate. And so that's ongoing right now. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what we're working on right now. Learned a few interesting things already. We can look at what's called technically a Voronoi analysis. And this is named after a Russian mathematician. The way to think of it is it looks at all the neighboring observations. Pick any observation and look at all of its neighbors. Mm-hmm. And see how all of its neighbors match that observation. Some things match better than others. When you collapse things down, you find that the matches go up. One of the things, however, that we don't have to collapse down to anything is freezing precipitation, freezing rain, and freezing drizzle. And what we find is that if we just put that into one class, freezing precipitation, comes down wet, freezes and stuff, we find that that has the least agreement with its neighbors. Now, that's an interesting problem. It's something that kind of surprised snow, rain, even ice pellets agree better than freezing rain does. Part of the issue is we think that we didn't have any big freezing rain events last year. People that experience it, of course, don't like it, but there were none of these broad, long-lasting freezing rain nightmares that just caused problems for weeks afterwards. We had little patches of it. We think that freezing rain may be really variable in space and time. And that's something that, in retrospect, we should have thought about, but we didn't really. We expected it to look like everything else. The other issue with freezing rain is it's pretty hard to observe. It's hard to observe it from inside your office or looking out your picture window at home, because until stuff begins to droop, it doesn't look any different from rain. Mm-hmm. And so unless you actually go outside and start looking at the leaves and feeling of them and checking everything, it just looks like rain. And so freezing rain is one of the tougher ones to catch.
Very cool. Well, I think we're running out of time. If there's any other questions anybody has here on the panel.
I did. I was just curious. You mentioned, Kim, about a quarter of a million reports. How many distributions and how many active posters?
Well, we have about 35,000 downloads of either the iPhone app or the Android app. We used to collect observations from the web as well, using this kind of kludgy system that I told you about we started with. We kept it going for a while, but it's hard to keep that secure, and it's hard to make it match up with the mobile apps. And by the way, the name of the app is still MPing, but the M and the P stand for something different with the new release, because we're not just looking at precipitation anymore. So now it's meteorological phenomenon identified near the ground. We wanted to keep the same acronym, but we wanted to generalize it a little bit better. So, yeah, people and acronyms. Anyway, I can look just. Hang on, let me not look at the camera and take, in fact, no, let me do one better. Let me take a look, and I can tell you right now.
As you're doing that, my last question would be, you said about 35,000 downloads, and yes, that is with little or no promotion/advertising of it. Is that correct? It was all kind of a viral distribution, or did you promote it in some way?
Well, we promoted it with NOAA promoted it with a press release. It's interesting to note.
That's right. I remember that.
It's interesting to note, by the way, that this was all developed by OU employees in cooperation with NOAA NSSL. Let's see. I'm looking at it. We have 235. I'm giving you round numbers. 235,000 reports, of which 220,000 are not tests. And so, and then I've got breakdowns at the wazoo, but of those 220,000, 50,000 were reports of none, and the rest were reports of something else. And the download numbers are about 35,000. We actually got the biggest hit, the biggest publicity hit, when I did an NPR segment from here. NPR interviewed me about this, and that gave us our biggest push of downloads. Before that, we would see, it's curious, there's some social stuff you could do with this too. For example, you could look at the rate of test reports, and we found that we could actually find cities where someone somehow learned about this, went out and talked to the National Weather Service, and then did a short story on it. And we would see cities light up with test reports. And we would see this all around.
Sweet.
And when we saw the NPR report, we saw the whole country light up with test reports, and we could see it move from east to west because NPR, you know, is on the West Coast is delayed. And so we saw the West Coast come an hour after everything else. And so I mean, it's all, the lights just went out in my office. I haven't been moving around enough. In any event, so now, they're back on again. So I had to wave my arms. So there's all kinds of stuff. And this data is going to be used for all kinds of things beyond what I've talked about here. There's nothing else in the world that exists quite like it. And so it's going to have a lot of different applications.
Very cool.
Okay, James. Well, yeah, thanks. Again, what we're going to have to do here is take a break. I'm looking at the clock on the wall up here and noticing that it's almost time for me to walk across the hall. But, Kim, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that? Twitter, Facebook, email, what? Pick your poison.
Well, I don't do Twitter. I don't tweet. We actually have an MPing Facebook presence. And so you can find it on Facebook. You could send me an email. I try to limit that because, I mean, I got stuff I have to do besides answer emails, which doesn't sound like I'm very interested, but I am really interested. But if I got inundated with 1,000 emails, there's just no way I could deal with it. We keep track of Facebook. You can email me. You can find me on the NOAA NSSL webpage. I'm right there, so I'm not hidden. And anybody that needs to can get a hold of me that way.
Okay, cool. Well, listen, Kim, thanks for your time. We know you stayed a lot longer than we projected, but you've been a great guest. It's a great project. Thanks for all your research work and all the things you do to support us guys in operational meteorology. So great having you on the show, and we hope to talk to you again real soon.
Oh, that's great. That's great. It's been fun, Jim. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good to see you again, too.
Yeah, great. Good to see you again. Thanks a lot. Okay.
All right, take care.
At this point, what we're going to do, I am going to roll this week, or I'm going to roll the Weather Brains 101, and I'm going to roll the fog bank, and then Kevin's going to take over while I do some television. So let's take a break for Weather Brains 101. We'll have Skydaver doing the fog bank, and then we'll be right back with JB's National Weather Roundup as Weather Brains rolls along.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
Before we delve into some of the forms of lightning, let's take a look at the history of lightning research. Much of this information came from the Lightning and Atmospheric Electricity Research at the Global Hydrology and Climate Center at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Benjamin Franklin, that familiar face on the $100 bill, performed the first systematic scientific study of lightning during the second half of the 18th century. Before Franklin, electrical science had developed to the point where positive and negative charges could be separated. Franklin was the first to design an experiment that conclusively proved the electrical nature of lightning. A similar experiment was performed by Thomas Francois Dalibard of France in May of 1752. Lightning proved deadly for one researcher, though, when G.W. Rickman, a Swedish physicist working in Russia in 1753, was killed when lightning struck him. Franklin showed that thunderstorms contain electricity by measuring the sign of the charge delivered through the kite apparatus, but Franklin was also able to infer that while the clouds were overhead, the lower part of the thunderstorm was generally negatively charged. Little significant progress occurred until the late 19th century when photography and spectroscopic tools became available for lightning research. Lightning current measurements were made in Germany by Pachels in the 1897 to 1900 time period when he analyzed the magnetic field induced by lightning currents to estimate the current values. Lightning research in the modern era got a boost with work by C.T.R. Wilson, who was the first to use electric field measurements to estimate the structure of thunderstorm charges involved in lightning. Wilson won the Nobel Prize in 1927 for the invention of the cloud chamber, and he made major contributions to our present understanding of lightning. Lightning research continued at a steady pace up to the late 1960s. Lightning research became particularly active then, primarily because of two factors. First, because of the danger of lightning to aerospace vehicles and to solid-state components used in computers and other devices. And second, because of improved measurement and observational capabilities made possible by advancing technology. Lightning displays are fascinating, so our next episode will look at some of the various forms lightning assumes.
Hello, WeatherBrains listeners. This is Dave Phillips. You can find the Fog Bank at skydaver.blogspot.com. Send me your links at Skydaver on Twitter. NOAA sent out a press release on one of the instruments to be placed on the GOES-R next-generation weather satellites. The astronomy picture of the day. Yes, astronomy had a fantastic picture of a supercell storm from Montana. The National Weather Service office in Pocatello, Idaho, had a press release on a gust front storm, or they, as they called it, a gustnado, that occurred there last week. Richard Foreman, the weather observer on Twitter, posted a pic of someone that sort of looks like Nate Johnson. Finally, from WDRB, video and a story about a massive ice floe coming ashore in Minnesota. Thanks for listening. Skydaver out.
And, of course, that is part of our picks of the week, and we're a little out of order here so we can get the recorded segments in. But at this time, I'm going to turn the floor over to Bill Murray. Bill, have you got a This Week in Weather History?
No, I've got nothing this week, James. Sorry.
Okay. In that case, we're going to do JB, and then we're going to do the email inbox, and we're going to do our picks of the week. And, by the way, if I'm not back in time, my pick of the week, it is the pretty interesting. It's the PDF that came out from the National Academy of Public Administration for the U.S. Congress and the National Weather Service. It says, forecast for the future, assuring the capacity of the National Weather Service. Where is the Weather Service going? It's a long document, and it has some interesting clues. Have a link that on weatherbrains.com. But, JB, I promised I'd roll you a new intro, so here you go.
When the weather ball is red, warmer weather is ahead. When the weather ball is white, colder weather is in sight. When the weather ball is green, no change in the weather is foreseen. When colors blink by night or day, precipitation's on the way.
All right, JB, the floor is yours.
Okay, I'll do it quickly. The coldest in the country this morning was 16 at Brimson, Minnesota. The highest this afternoon was 115 in Death Valley. And 10 this morning in Notak, Alaska, was the coldest in Alaska. 91 degrees this afternoon in Bismarck, which was a record for the date. And it was sunny with a dew point of 38 and a relative humidity of 16% with 24-mile-an-hour winds and a soil temperature of 41 at the 60-inch depth. So can you imagine what the snow melt's going to look like? It was 93 this afternoon in St. George, Utah, and 105 in Yuma, 36 inches of snow on the ground at Valdez, Alaska, only a trace at Anchorage, and absolutely none at Fairbanks. That's most unusual. The big sheet of thick ice that formed over Lake Superior and part of some of the southern Canadian lakes got so heavy and so thick that it started pushing its way south, and it got down into extreme northern Minnesota and destroyed a number of homes and also some in southern Canada. Denver got 85 degrees this afternoon, and that's it.
Wow. Thank you, JB. I guess we're not going to have the email jingle, Nate. So you want to roll right into this week's email?
You know, I'm trying to juggle guests and keep up with Twitter, and then I've got Space Flight now up on another window, keeping an eye on that. You know, by the way, they're all three out of the Soyuz capsule now. Nice. They all seem to be fine. They're now getting ready for the traditional Kazakh welcoming ceremony. And this is fascinating. And I asked on Twitter, you know, when was the last time you had this many people care this much about a Russian space capsule coming back to Earth? I mean, this is the power of social media. This is, I mean, nobody would know who Chris Hadfield is if it wasn't for Twitter and YouTube and the fact that he's just really good at that.
And I'm probably when Wallowitz went up on Big Bang.
Yeah. That Soyuz thing is kind of small because they have a mock-up of that. You know, I told you we were at NASA Johnson Space Center, and and in the practice area for the astronauts, they've got a mock-up of the Soyuz, and that's a little bitty thing for three guys to be in.
It is a teeny weeny little thing. It takes them forever to get. I mean, they've been down for a half hour now. And it's taken them this long. They just now got Hadfield out. He was the last one. So
they should design it. It lands on the ground. It should just crack open like an egg, maybe. Doesn't that make
yeah.
sense?
Well, apparently, this is one of the things I found out just watching the stream on Twitter, is that at the 5 seconds before the landing is so hard that 5 seconds before they do the landing, they remind the guys in the capsule to close their mouths. And the reason for that is that the landing is so hard, you bite your tongue clean off. If you're not right there.
Isn't there some little rocket boost right before, though?
Yeah, so there's one last little rocket boost that basically tries to soften the landing just to sort of, you know, null it down a little bit. And then there are a couple of really large shock absorbers inside that suppress the shock on the astronauts and the inside of the capsule, but was likened to a really bad car wreck going backwards, which does not sound like any kind of fun to me.
So anyway, I love the email.
Yeah, so we have a little email tonight. Not a lot, and I guess thankfully, given the way things are going, although that means our viewers and listeners are letting us down. We have one listener survey response from Kevin in New Hampshire. And would like to have us maybe talk a little bit about Mount Washington sometime, or extreme weather stations in general. And I know we've had some folks from Mount Washington on in the past.
Oh, and you know what? You know what that reminds me of? I'm sorry to interrupt you. I actually did research. We talked about that. You know, Brian, you said last week you were going up there. I was mistaken. The Mount Washington Auto Road is, in fact, paved.
Oh.
I just needed to correct that because I was wrong and it was bugging me. There are places where it sort of looks like really hard packed dirt, but it is largely a paved road. So sorry to interrupt you, but you reminded me of that. So thank
you. Not a problem. So a couple emails from Wallace Stuckey, friend of the show. One, a YouTube clip of our friends at that national weather outlet based in Atlanta, and their thing where they had people tweeting a particular hashtag to try and get folks to create wind in the intern office. I'm pretty sure that violated some sort of law about you know, treatment of interns, but it is what it is. And Wallace mentions that he's not a fan of the Weather Channel anymore.
I think that's don't put the interns in the tornado simulator clause, isn't it?
Yes, I'm pretty sure I didn't have to sign anything like that when I was an intern. But anyway, I also sent a clip of actual weather on the Weather Channel back in 1985. That's almost how far back you have to go to get some.
Wow.
Our Estonian correspondent Tarmo Tenelsu sent us a note from talking about some severe weather in Europe, actually. And they have sent us a link to the European Severe Storms Lab, the ESSL. At least I hope that's what that's short for. When you start talking about Europe, you get into foreign languages, and that could mean something completely different. But ESSL.org, the severe weather database, so you can track some of that. He mentioned that he saw an impressive shelf cloud this morning, and finally mentioned that he was not able to send us an audio message this week because but he did include a piece of historic audio, which unfortunately we can't play because James had to, you know, go do his day job. But this is the first overpass of the EstCube 1 satellite over his home last Tuesday. And about 5 hours after the launch, he calls it Estonia's Sputnik. And we'll maybe play that next week. I listened to it. I initially thought it was a bad encoding because it was just all static. And then all of a sudden you hear this very characteristic set of beeps. It was pretty cool. So there's that. And finally, we have a couple of links, one from Daniel Lucas and one from Mike Moss. One of those, a storm chase video, and then the other one, an article from, I believe that's AlabamaWX.com, and I'm not sure. Nope, I'm sorry. That is news articles for the USDOD, forgive me. And talk about a weather airman overcoming a lightning strike in Dateline Southwest Asia. So we'll post a link to that on the website. And that is it for the Weather Brains email for this week.
Masterfully done. Thank you very kindly, sir. Let's move on to picks of the week. Bill Murray, you want to start?
Kevin, we were trying hard to have Patrick Marsh on, but with the invitation problems tonight, we couldn't have him. But Patrick, of course, is a former guest of the show. And my pick of the week tonight is a story that he put on his blog and updated later this week. Thanks, Nate, for pointing that out. But his Playing with Data blog, he posted about the relative minimum of tornadoes that we've had over the past 12 months. And he compared that to the maximum that occurred during a 12-month period from 2011 to 2012. And by his calculations, by running a very simple model, he says that the return period of the maximum that we saw in 2011 and 2012 is nearly 75,000 years before we would see that sort of an event again.
Wow.
No, I'm sorry, 63,000 years. That's a long time.
Yeah,
that's a long time. You know, in the 99.9th percentile.
Wow.
And the return period for the observed minimum is, you know, something on the order of 3,731 years. So we wanted to have Patrick on to talk about this because it really points out, you know, that we had this extreme amount of tornadoes in 2011 and 12, and now we've had an almost similarly historic minimum number, and his data goes back 59 years, and it's pretty interesting. And Brian's got the pics there from me, so he's got a link to that for the blog. So anybody have any comments on Patrick's data?
You reminded me that Brad Panovich posted on his Google Plus page a little earlier something related. He said, add up all the tornadoes over the past 12 months and you get 661. He said that's less than April 2011 when we had 758 in that month alone.
Well, it's very fascinating. And Harold Brooks, who works out there and is a former guest of the show, too, you know, they did a big event here in Birmingham last April. And he says that it's because of his extreme mastery of that event that we've had this minimum. So he wants to keep it going. He says that he's the reason that the tornadoes have been.
So, anyway, you know, when you talk about this stuff, though, it always and this applies to many, many other things, too, because we talk about this a lot in my house, is that averages are made of extremes. And you have to remember that when you're in an extreme year and when you're in an average year, because that's just the way it is.
And my other pick of the week is a Buffalo Rock Diet Ginger Ale in honor of JB. JB, there you go.
Nice.
All right.
No alcohol in the serving of this. And our pick next week, if we get Google Plus straightened out, is Tom Slatter. And who is Tom Slatter? Who can tell me that?
On this, I knew Paul Slatter is.
Mrs. Slatter's husband.
Very good, Kevin. That's an alternative acceptable answer.
Thank you.
He is the editor of the QA program on the WeatherWise magazine. So, he's been doing this for 33 years.
Wow,
he's been doing that for 33 years, and we've been trying for about that long to get him on Google Plus. So we'll see how that goes.
Very good. All right, thank you, Bill. Let's move down the line, Professor Peters. Your pick of the week, sir.
Don't have one.
Come on.
It's been a busy week there, Kevin. So,
okay.
Brian's got nothing.
J.B. Elliott, do you have a pick of the week, sir?
David Phillips, as we all know, is our friend. He's especially my friend because he's saved my life on a lot of these nights, giving me one. So he reset last week's because I wasn't here. And it is a lightning photo that was put on Twitter by the U.S. Department of Interior. And it's an awesome picture of lightning.
Beautiful shot. Yeah, it really is. I like lightning pictures. I actually tried my first time. I got my first DSLR last year, and Matthew and I set it up in the garage one day. I think it's actually on my Flickr profile, but I was lucky enough to get a nice lightning shot from the house, and I would like to do more, but do it safely, of course. All right, JB, thank you.
Yes,
Dr.
Sir.
Johnson, what do you say?
I had the pleasure to stumble across last week the Time Magazine and Google collaboration of the 30-year Landsat time lapse. What they've done, we're used to seeing satellite time lapses. You see them on the news. James is probably standing in front of one of them as we speak here at 11:11 on, I guess this is Monday night, May the 13th. as we record this. But anyway, what they've done is they have this satellite that takes these high-resolution land use pictures of the Earth and pretty much every square inch of the place. And they set up a time lapse of 30 years of that data. And it is fascinating. Take a, you know, go to the website. And I didn't think I saw this for a couple of days. And like, yeah, whatever. It's dirt. Who cares? And then I'm like, oh, I'm going to play with this. And I go and zoom into the Raleigh-Durham metropolitan area. And I time lapse that. And it's like watching Sim City right before your eyes, except it's the real thing. You could see Interstate 540 get built. You could see the US 264 out to the east. You could see the tollway on the west side of town. You could see all of this build out from the city center all the way out the sort of, you know, I wouldn't call it sprawl here. It's not quite that bad, but you know, the suburbs really starting to fill out, especially to the west, southwest, and southeast. And that's just one area. Las Vegas is one area that just has blown up in the last 30 years. Yep. And another one was to go and look at the Outer Banks of North Carolina, Oregon Inlet, for example, and to see the shifting sands, literally just the shifting sands over the last 30 years along the Outer Banks. And just sort of get a sense of just how fragile this blue marble we live on. Kind of is. Before we get too far afield from Bill and Patrick Marsh, he and I have been tweeting back and forth. He says two things. Number one, it is the European Severe Storms Laboratory, and he says he's the only U.S. member of the ESSL. So we really missed out on that tonight. Really nice. Would have been nice to have Google work, but it's not working tonight. And then he also says April 2011 has more EF1 or stronger tornadoes than the next two biggest months on record, including May of 2003, which is second, and less than half of the total from 2001. Uh-huh. And then April of 2011 also has more EF or EF1 tornadoes than order of half of the years on record. In other words, that one month beats out most, about half of the half years. That's crazy.
Yeah,
that's think about real how bad that year, that month was when we're talking about it's got more than half the years on record. So
very good.
Appreciate Patrick chiming in. And unfortunately, we couldn't get him on for the technical difficulties. But Patrick, we appreciate that. We'll have him on a future edition.
Thank you, Nate. My pick of the week, once again, going back to our conversation with Brian of last week, I just got to remembering my trip up to Mount Washington. And I'm so excited for you, Brian, going up there. I think it's going to be a fun trip.
Me too.
And so my pick of the week is the Mount Washington Weather Center. It's currently 19.6 degrees there. The wind is out of the northwest at almost 40 miles per hour, giving us a wind chill of minus 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit. But there's a ton of stuff on that site. And if you go to the main page, they've got a bunch of I don't know if we call them tower cams, a bunch of cameras up there, including some looking at the. I haven't done it as much lately. I don't know why, but I used to just constantly go to the webcam at the summit from the weather building up there, because to watch people walk around on the deck or to watch inclement weather is really fun. And Brian, you know what's really cool that you can see on some of those cameras a lot of the time? You mentioned, you know, wanting to have a clear day when you go up there. If you do it right, what you can get is what they call an undercast up there. If the cloud deck is low enough, and I think that would be fascinating to see in person, but obviously you'd have to have the right conditions, and I don't think it happens all that often, but that is basically when you're above the cloud deck being up on top of Mount Washington. So I'm excited to hear about your trip.
I'm excited to do it.
Very good. All right, I think that's it. Bill, do you have anything to tease for us weeks ahead here?
No, just Tom Slatter. We've got guests for the next 3 weeks, but I don't have that pulled up right now, Kevin. So, and then we'll be looking for guests. If you have any suggestions, send them to the show. We can use them.
Awesome. And anybody, I actually have two messages for the broadcasters in the audience, and I know we have a number of them and a growing number of them. If you'd love to be a guest weather brain or like to be on a future episode, just send us a note. We'd love to have you on. We, you know, really enjoy getting people from around the country and finding out the local weather, and that's one of the things that the email folks recommend to us or ask us for is, you know, we tend to focus on Texas and the Southeast because that's where all of us are. But you folks in the mountains or in the Pacific Northwest or anywhere, Canada, wherever it would be, if you want to come on the show as a guest weather brain, a guest panelist one day, we would love to have you do that. You can
totally love to have Canadians on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. We can. You can find us at email at weatherbrains.com. I also want to make, and this is more of a tease than anything, but there will be more information coming in the weeks ahead. And this, again, is for the broadcasters. I would love for all of you listening, if you have not created a Google Plus profile yet, I would love for you to do that and then search for the broadcast meteorologists community. And Brad Panovich started that, but a bunch of us are in it. But there are going to be some neat things coming within that community that are specifically for broadcasters with the goal of creating some stuff for everybody in the weeks ahead. And I won't say anything more right now, but again, if you're a broadcaster, I would love to have you make a Google Plus profile, put me in your circle, and then go and look for the broadcast meteorologist community. That's a closed group. So if you're not a broadcast meteorologist, you won't be allowed in. And I'm sorry about that, but you have to be approved to get into that group. So you can put in your name into that group, but one of the moderators will have to approve you on that. But again, some really cool things coming up in the weeks ahead, and hopefully even by next week, I'll have some announcements for that, and I'd appreciate you all doing that. And we need to mention the contest. Oh, and James isn't here to play our rules again, so I guess we'll just have to remember those from the first part of the program. But what we would love to do is see your home screen from your smartphone. And what we're trying to find out is what weather apps you're using. And if you've got a ton of them and want to send us a screen share or a screenshot of your weather apps folder, we'd love to see that too. And there's a little bit more on that on the Digital Meteorologist blog, where I got that idea based on something from Fred Wilson. But the email address, don't send, you won't be in the drawing for the James Spann bobblehead doll. We will give away one signed James Spann bobblehead doll. But if you send to email at weatherbrains.com, you won't be in the drawing. You have to send it to myapps, M-Y-A-P-P-S, at weatherbrains.com. And we appreciate your participation in that. And you have until a week from this program, actually Sunday night. I think it's the, was it the 13th? No, today's the 13th. Whatever, the 19th. Sunday night, just before midnight, would be the entry time deadline. So we appreciate that. Anybody else got any news?
I got nothing.
Everybody's got nothing. That means it is time to go. Everybody stay watching the live. Stay and watch, because one of the funniest parts of this is when we all leave and James comes back in the room and he sits down and sometimes he just sits and talks for like 5 or 10 minutes by himself. And that'll show up on the YouTube. Yeah, he just talks and he just goes on. But anyway, we appreciate you watching. We do this show almost always on Monday nights at 8:30 Central. You can listen to it or watch it live at live@bigbrainsmedia.com. The website is weatherbrains.com. The email address is email at weatherbrains.com, and all the social media contacts are there as well. As always, I am not James Spann. Have a great week, and God bless.